if I want to talk about the more literal translation from the Pali for this word, it actually more literally translates, in my understanding, as being a messy space. Sometimes used as being a dirty space, but it's a messy space. Ka is space, and the duke is the messiness. So that's helps already to reframe it. But of course, dukkha is what sets the context. It sets the framework for the entirety of this path of exploration. It sets the context for every path of insight meditation. It certainly sets a path for all mindfulness-based applications. They are concerned with understanding dukkha. Now, again, this is a word where there really isn't a good English translation. And there's a lot of very poor English translations of dukkha. So the two dimensions of this, because this is both a personal, dukkha is both a personal, and indeed it is a universal story. Because the strands of dukkha run through all of our lives, and none of us are exempt. Now, this is not a Buddhist story. This is a human story. And it's important for us to be, I think, incredibly clear about what dukkha actually means. As I mentioned earlier, the Buddha summarized his teaching by saying, I teach only one thing, there is dukkha, and there is the end of dukkha. And this is, of course, the third ennobling truth of awakening. It's the end of dukkha for it not to arise again. Now, also referring to an earlier quote I used, that all conditioned phenomena are dukkha. Now, when dukkha is so unfortunately and simplistically translated as suffering, this quote indeed sounds very grim. And sometimes you hear that kind of floated around in Buddhist circles, you know? Life is suffering. Well, actually, it's not true. And it doesn't ring true in our experience. When you hold a newborn baby, you rarely think, oh, this is really suffering. And you look out at the color of the leaves on the trees, you don't think, oh, this is really suffering. So what is meant by dukkha? So here we really speak about three different dimensions of dukkha. The first is dukkha-dukkha. The second is viparinama-dukkha. And the third is sankhata or sankhara-dukkha. So it's very important. You're clear there's these three different dimensions, and they're all distinctly different. So dukkha-dukkha means simply the pain of pain. It is the pain of pain. There is pain in having a body, the pain of illness, the pain of aging, the pain of death, the vulnerability of the body in a world of changing conditions that can adversely affect the health and well-being of the body. This is not a complicated dimension of dukkha, dukkha-dukkha. You know, it covers everything from the niggling, unpleasant sensation and itch to the discomforts that are part of all of our days. A little hungry, a little cold, a little uncomfortable, to the more severe pains and illnesses and traumas we can experience. Dukkha-dukkha also covers the pain of some of our emotional and mental states. The pain of grief, of sorrow, of lamentation, the pain of alienation, of loneliness, of anxiety. The simple reality, this is painful. It's not a particularly subjective experience. It's just dukkha-dukkha, double dukkha. The pain of pain. Now, the second dimension of dukkha, viparinama dukkha, refers actually to what we were speaking about this morning, the dukkha held within the world of instability and change. And again, this is not about our reactions to change. But the reality that all conditioned phenomena, all experience, all sense impressions, all events held within this reality, that they will not last, that they will arise and fade, that they are unpredictable. So this includes the world of the pleasant and the unpleasant. It's not confined to the world of the unpleasant. Concludes the world of the pleasant and the unpleasant. They are dukkha, simply in their inherent incapacity to offer security, certainty, or predictability. That this world of change and conditions offers no lasting refuge, no implicit happiness or safety to be found within that which is essentially unstable. Okay? So the world, it's just recognizing the world of conditions is essentially unmanageable, uncontrollable. We will experience joy, love, happiness. We will experience sadness or unhappiness. All of it will change. None of it can be maintained. This is this dimension of dukkha. It is simply describing the way things are. There's no emotional tone in here. It's not about how I react to that or how I relate to it. It's simply describing the nature of conditions and process. So this is emotionally neutral. Now, when the Buddha says, I teach just one thing, that there is dukkha and there is the end of dukkha, clearly he's not speaking about ending the realities of illness, aging, or death. He's not suggesting that he's found some magical way of bringing impermanence and instability to an end. So what the Buddha is actually concerned with, and what this path is actually concerned with primarily, is the third dimension of dukkha, which is sankhata or sankhara dukkha. The first two domains of dukkha are not optional. The third domain of dukkha is where the path actually comes in. So sankhata or sankhara dukkha is actually describing the confused relationship that we form with the first two domains of dukkha. It's describing the world of our emotional and psychological habits and reactions that are superimposed upon the first two domains of dukkha. This is sankhata or sankhara dukkha. Many of you will be familiar with the word sankhara, the patterning of our world, the patterning of our experience through distorted ways of seeing. Now, is everybody here familiar with the story of the two darts?
The two darts.
Is anybody not familiar with this? Okay, here goes. Okay, so imagine there is a unmindful, uninformed, deluded person who gets shot by a dart, and they experience the pain of that wound. So they experience that first kind of pain, the physical pain of the wound. And then they lament, and they bewail, and they complain, and they resist. You know, where did this dart come from? Why is it here? Why is it happening to me? And thus they experience the pain almost of being struck by a second dart. So they are experiencing both the physical pain of the first dart and the psychological and emotional pain of the second dart. And then the Buddha says, imagine a mindful, informed, insightful person who gets shot by a dart. They experience exactly the same pain as the unmindful, uninformed person. But they don't lament and wail and complain and say, why has this happened to me and this shouldn't be happening. Therefore, they experience only the pain of the first dart and not the pain of the second dart. Now, that metaphor, that teaching story that the Buddha uses, pretty much sums up the whole of the path of meditative development and the whole of the path of insight. We are looking at this second dart. This is sankhata or sankhara dukkha. So we're looking at the anguish that can be transformed, that all meditative practice is concerned with. So the teaching of the third noble truth of awakening were dukkha, and its causes have been understood and brought to cessation. And the Buddha really only had one thing to say about dukkha. He said dukkha is to be understood. Not to be resisted, not to be blamed. Dukkha is to be understood. So sankhata dukkha is really describing the volitional tendencies and patterns that arise in the moment that create and recreate psychological, emotional anguish and suffering. Now, when I use the word volitional, we need to be very clear. When we hear the word volition, we often translate as actually, I mean it, or I intend it, or it's something conscious. Whereas when the Buddha talks about volitional patterns, they are actually the movements, the impulses. So they are not necessarily conscious or intentional. They include all of the reflexive reactions, the automatic reactivity, the impulses, all of this falls within volitional patterns that arise in relationship to contact. So it's very important to be clear about that. And as far as Buddhist psychology goes, this is karma, or karma, as you may have heard it. This is karma. This is the movement. This is the action, the psychological and emotional action. This is what karma is within this realm of sankharas or volitional action. Is everybody quite okay with that? So dukkha, as we're describing it here, the kind of psychological emotional map, this is not something that is static. It's not like life is dukkha. This is not something that is static. It's not a life sentence. It's not a terminal condition. But dukkha is something that is being created and recreated moment to moment through volitional formations or sankharas. It's being, so dukkha is being brought into creation through the activation of psychological and emotional patterns and habits that are superimposed upon the bare actuality of what is actually being experienced. 1,000 examples. You brought it up earlier, the sound of the door, the annoyance. That is volitional impulse. The sound of the plane, the fantasy of a vacation. That is volitional impulse. The itch in your back, the thought about something biting you. That is volitional impulse. All of this is what sankhata or sankhara dukkha is. And this is something that is being triggered, isn't it? It's being triggered by sensory impression and contact moment to moment. And you've noticed how quickly there is the meeting together of sensory impression and sankharas. And sankharas, this patterning, this emotional and psychological patterning. Feels very reflexive, feels very automatic.
Sorry? Why is it volitional?
It's because it's movement. It's movement. It's a trigger into being. It's volition. It's a formation. So the word volition here is used in a very, very specific way as being a movement of the mind, a movement of the emotional world, but primarily a movement of the sankharas from dormancy or latency into activity. And remember yesterday when we talked about asavas, the leakage. Volitional impulse is the leaks. Does anybody have any? Yes.
So my question is, just to get clear on the second form of dukkha, how would that be different from, I'm thinking from an enlightened place or awakened place, that would just be seeing impermanence clearly.
Impermanence and instability.
So how?
So that it has no lasting refuge. So it's just a simple statement of the way things are. There's no emotional tone to it at all. We have an emotional reaction to it,
right.
But that's sankhara dukkha.
No, I get that. I think I guess I'm just wondering why there's a whole separate. It just seems like it's impermanence. And either you.
It's impermanence and it's instability. That's all it is. It's that simple.
Yeah.
But this is a kind of layering of dukkha. This is a, and actually the way that it is put as dukkha, which is not necessarily suffering, is it's unsatisfactory, in that it cannot provide any lasting refuge or security.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I heard a while back, I don't remember who the teacher was, when they described dukkha. That these are not additive, but multiplicative in our suffering. In other words, if I have a 10 dukkha dukkha, and then I have a sankhara dukkha of 10, or pain and resistance, if I put pain of 10 with resistance of 10, I don't get 20 negative, I get 100 negative. And all of a sudden that made sense to me that, oh boy, sure, I'm going to have tens all the time, but I don't have to have hundreds all the time. Would you agree with that? Well,
sankhara dukkha is essentially inflammatory, isn't it? It's inflammatory. So it is taking a bare actuality and it's making it inflammatory. And actually, we don't know whether we have, 20 times, 100 times, a million times, could be anything within there. That spectrum, but it is always inflammatory. It is always inflammatory.
What about the notion of different people have different pain tolerances? It's got nothing to do with posture around the pain. For some people, a dart is going to be a little poke. For other people, it's going to be a stabbing deep in the chest.
It's still dukkha dukkha. It's still dukkha, it's the pain of pain. And, that wouldn't necessarily have much to do with emotional reaction at all. It just has simply to do with what the body is accustomed or able to tolerate, or feel. But it's still dukkha dukkha on that level. It's just the spectrum of dukkha dukkha can be from the niggle to the severe, acute pain. This is still within dukkha dukkha. Even within that, there can be the presence of sankhara dukkha or not. For some people with a low pain tolerance, a mosquito bite is unbearable. So sankhara dukkha, this is something we can do something about. This is a place where we're not helpless. Now I want to give you a little bit of a sense of the landscape of sankhara dukkha. Not in order to depress you, but just a little bit to unpack the term. So we start with the big ones, the big sankharas, greed, hatred, delusion. These are the big patterns. They're the kind of monster patterns, but each of these has a really big family, doesn't it? I mean, we talk about greed, hatred, and delusion in these simplistic terms, but in truth, they They have a huge family, close and distant cousins. They would include jealousy, envy, craving for becoming, sensual craving. They would include doubt and speculative views. Greed, hatred, and delusion has the family of the hindrance factors of restlessness, of worry, of aversion, of craving, of sloth and torpor. They would include despair and confusion. And Sankhata Dukkha would include clinging and mana. So this is kind of like the huge landscape of Sankhata Dukkha. You know, if you look in the Abhidhamma, I think they're going to come up with about 72 different manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion. In fact, Sankhata Dukkha includes all of the unskillful, reactive patterns that are suffering in themselves and who have only the outcome of more suffering. So in other words, within the realm of this unskillful, unhelpful, there are no good outcomes. There are no good outcomes. And of course, the repetition of them makes them more habitual and more potent and more of a default mechanism. Much of the world of emotional and psychological distress is actually, again, the arguments that we engage in with the inarguables of living in a body that's subject to aging, a world of changing unstable conditions, and the changes we fear and find difficult to welcome. So this is where Sankhata Dukkha is coming into play. This is the argument, the resistance, the refusal, the rejection, the fear, the anxiety around the unarguables. This is mostly the world that we live in. When we're in distress, this is the world we're living in. We're actually living in the world of sankharas. This kind of patterning that is superimposed upon most things. Now, again, these are volitional impulses. And I'm using the word impulses here very, very specifically, because this is what takes this whole word volitional out of some idea of this being conscious and intended and purposeful. They are volitional impulses. But simply, they are the volitions of physical, verbal, and mental acts. This is what volition is. Physical, verbal, and mental acts. All of our thoughts, our constructions, our fabrications, our speech, and then the way that they spill over into a behavioral sense of how we act. Physical, verbal, and mental acts. And as I mentioned, this is karma, or karma. This is it's pretty much a state of constant process, isn't it? We're always acting in some way, physically, verbally, psychologically. A sense that we are always kind of engaged in something, we are always practicing something in our minds, speech, and bodies. This goes right from, you know, the kind of reflective scratch of an itch, you know, to the thought that just seems to spill out of nowhere, to the words that come out of our mouths, that we're actually always engaged in action. So we are always engaged in karma. Consciously or unconsciously, this is happening. Now, it's not difficult to see, I think, that when our body, speech, and mind are really held in the grip of these patterns, these are the places actually where we suffer the most. Where there's the most anguish, the most sense of being out of control, the most sense of being helpless, the most sense of being overwhelmed. It's kind of like the express train, often. You know, here it is. Now, And as I say, it's even greater suffering when there's sufficient mindfulness in place to know what's happening and yet to feel powerless before the force of those habits. Now, these are difficult places in practice, you know, to have a sufficient wakefulness. Now, what is the Buddha's response to these volitional impulses? It's intention. It's actually intention. And, you know, it's often said that the whole of this path rests upon the head of the pin of intention. Because it is intention that is actually starting to take us out of impulse. It's intention that's moving us into mindfulness. It's intention that's moving us into choice. An intentional life. An intentional sitting posture. Intentional speech. Intentional thought. Now, this is kind of the lifeline out of sankharas. It's this cultivation of clear and wise intention. It is the forerunner of our thoughts, our speech, our actions, our choices. When the Buddha spoke about the cultivation of wise intention, it wasn't a complex discussion. There's only three. It's a very short list. It's very easy to remember. Metta, compassion, renunciation. It's a very short list. That whenever those intentions are present, impulses are not. Whenever those intentions are clearly held within the light of attention, impulse is essentially stopped. So you could see the way that mindfulness and intentionality are so working closely hand in hand. Because one of the translations of mindfulness of sati, present moment recollection, is a better phrase than mindfulness. Whenever sati is in place, there is a quality of remembering. There's a quality of remembering about remembering where we actually locate our attention, what we set our hearts upon, and it is these three primary pathways of intentionality. They are not separate ones, by the way. They're not separate pathways. Metta, compassion, and renunciation. Is that clear for you? Well, they can. I mean, I think in a lot of traditions, compassion is actually not seen to be as separate. It's really almost an extension of metta. Sometimes it's described as being an outgoing kindness or an enacted kindness. Metta, compassion, renunciation. I think they're interwoven because, you know, metta clearly is a kind of release from ill will. Compassion is very much a release from the fear of suffering. But they are always operating hand in hand.
What about a young child who's been raised with compassion? It's natural mental processes reach out with compassion and they haven't been taught mindfulness. But they don't necessarily react, but it seems like
Buddha Sankara. One shouldn't imagine that somehow, you know, this is a Buddha story. This is a human story. You know, there are plenty of, you know, or I don't know about plenty, but there are certainly people in this world who are possessed of enormous compassion and generosity and kindness and renunciation, who've never sat in a cushion for a moment. You know, we may have met them. This is not particularly a Buddha story. What the Buddha story is doing is offering a specific training. And also, it is not about producing something that is not of it, where the seeds are not already present within us. You know, we are not inventing kindness or compassion in our hearts and minds. The seeds of these are already present. So what is actually happening in a path of training is the cultivation of those seeds and bringing them to fruition. This is why it's not a Buddhist story. The Buddhist story is about the discipline and the roadmap and the kind of the pathway of cultivation. This is a kind of great gift of the Buddha's legacy. But it's not like, you know, somehow there's a kind of ownership of compassion or kindness and generosity. These are very human. Some come to them without a great deal of training. Most don't.
I was just going to mention an observation that those habit patterns, those volitional formation, if one really looks at what makes up
except
generally what you find is the vast majority, with the understanding that maybe that's 90%, but there's 10% room for intention. And that's sort of the that's the crack in the door to put metta.
Yes, that basically kind of sums it up. I mean, if we actually really do deconstruct our sense of self, I mean, I don't usually like to say this because it does sound a bit insulting. Basically a collection of habits. I'd say we're a collection of habits. and actually, you know, I mean, that's not, that mustn't be heard judgmentally. You know, many of those habits have been formed through experience. They've been perfected through practice and repetition, until they become the default mechanism of this is what I am. This is what I am. But as I mentioned, it's not every moment in the day that this kind of selfing is operating. There's many moments actually when it's not operating at all. Because the kind of craving and aversion aren't operating. When craving and aversion aren't operating, there may indeed be a sense of mana lurking around in the background, but there's not. Selfing is an active process. It's an active process. It is an active process of formation. So of craving and aversion, clinging and shaping of the selfing of the moment. So selfing is an active process. It's not some kind of constant abiding. And that's the good news. It's not a constant presence. I mean, there may be a background delusion still of mana, of conceit of self, but the active processing of selfing is not occurring in every moment. I don't think we would find the courage to open our eyes in the morning if that was so. You know, we would say, oh, another day of, you know, non-stop selfing. You know, this is an arising and passing sankhara. Selfing is arising and passing sankhara, resting upon the foundations of craving, aversion, and clinging. So when we actually talk about the cultivation of intention, we're actually talking about what is another process that is instigated. So, you know, here we are, a body of processes, many of them volitional impulses, but it's not the entirety of consciousness. And actually what we are doing is about instigating another process of cultivation rather than of volitional impulse. And that cultivation is this inclination towards intentionality. Intentionality that is flavored by metta, compassion, and renunciation. Now, you can almost see this kind of set of scales. Can't you? As long as one side of the scales is weighted heavily by sankharas, you know, it drags that side of the scales down and the other one's kind of flapping around in the air, you know. So actually what we're doing is actually we're learning to weight the scales, you know, through this. But cultivation here is such a critical word, You know, and it is at the heart of this teaching that this is not an accident. It's not something reserved for a spiritually elite. It's not reserved for the graduates. You know, this is actually a pathway of cultivation throughout the whole of it. It is why in the early text you see so many of the kind of agricultural, you know, metaphors and similes. We're growing something. We're growing something. That's the kind of language the Buddha used all the time. You know, we're planting the seeds, we're watering them, we're nourishing them. We're actually growing something. And again, the language fails because we say we are doing it. Huh? But it is that kind of shift in heart away from forgetfulness into remembering. And every moment of remembering is a moment of cultivation. Because mindfulness here is not attitudinally neutral. You know, sati is never attitudinally neutral. Sati actually has the flavors of metta, compassion, and renunciation. That is the flavor of sati. It's not just paying attention. And mana is part of sankhata dukkha. Okay? It's not exempt from the world of intentionality. You know, the moment there's intentionality, there is the beginning of investigation, the beginning of unpacking, you know, the beginning of not being held in the grip of. And also when... I think it's also important when we think about intentionality, you know, this is something very different than resolve. I mean, everybody probably knows that New Year's resolutions don't work that well for most people because they have no foundation. So intentionality is much more to do with how the mind is inclined. How the mind is inclined towards something. So when we look at, you know, say like metta or compassion or as formal practices, we're inclining the mind towards that capacity for befriending, for understanding, for releasing aversion. But that intentionality, of course, is also has many, you know, has a lot of background in terms of ethics, integrity, mindfulness, you know, all of those. So it's not about a resolve, you know. I mean, certainly it can be helpful to sort of go into our day with a recollection of those intentions. But that recollection will not work unless there is the background climate of sati, particularly of sati and integrity. The intentions won't work. And that's why often resolutions are so desperately unsuccessful. Because there's no ground to hold them. So there's a very big difference between intentionality and resolve. Although intentionality can be consciously recalled, which we hope that we do, you know, consciously recalled and remembered, all of that recalling and remembering is in the service of inclining our hearts towards that capacity for befriending, for compassion, for releasing, rather than I'm going into my day and I'm going to have a really, you know, a day of metta, you know, or a day of compassion. So it's something very different than that. So just one thing. So you cannot abstract any aspect of the Buddhist teaching from the whole. You know, so you cannot abstract, for example, intentionality from the whole framework of ethics and sati, and all of those big pieces. You can't just abstract renunciation from the whole. You know, you can't just abstract mindfulness from the whole. One has to actually consider the whole of the teaching and its interconnected nature, that this is a landscape of awakening and not just a kind of a list that we tick off. You know, I've got some mindfulness over here, you know, and I, you know, I've got some investigation over here, and I've got some energy in, over here. Just as we talk about the world of dukkha as being a combination of these interactive processes of avidya, you know, of volitional impulses, sankharas, of forgetfulness. So when we talk about the landscape of sankhata dukkha, we're talking also about a landscape of interacting factors. When we talk about the landscape of ending dukkha, we're also talking about the landscape of this interactive processes and conditions. So it's quite impossible to just to abstract and separate and, you know, have a pick and choose selection. You know, I think I'll do some sati, but I won't do some sila. It's or integrity. It's not going to work. It's simply not going to work. Which is why it's so important to have an overview of the whole of the teaching. Sorry, what?
I was just about to be asked to be disabused of that issue of taking confidence.
Yeah.
Because it was, I had an idea that if sankhara dukkha stresses anxieties in a clinical sense. From what you were just saying, it seems like the direct
I mean, it has been shown in many situations of psychological and emotional distress that compassion training, mindfulness training, all of these trainings can actually be extraordinarily helpful. Now, this is a story that's still being written, isn't it? We haven't actually come to the end of this story. We know that compassion training is helpful, even for people who've never heard of the Buddhist teaching. You know, we know that mindfulness training can be helpful, even if people have never heard of the Buddhist teaching. What we do know also is that this is an incomplete story. You know, we're not talking about 20 years of actually seeing, or 30 years of seeing how that evolves in a human being's consciousness. We're knowing that there can be the immediacy of effect, and I think that's awesome. I think that's awesome. However, I guess I have very big questions if we do not undo the seeds of the second arrow. You know, we don't want to be... I mean, I'm all for Band-Aid treatment, you know. I'm all for anything that relieves suffering, you know. I think if we talk about a sort of very genuine, deeper liberation from the causes of sankhata dukkha, people will probably need to both continue or go deeper.
But I mean, this is not external, but that's the broad overview.
Yeah. So things can be abstracted in a sense. And it's happening all the time in our world at the moment, that, you know, like particularly sati is being abstracted to treat psychological distress. And it's very effective. But as I say, it's not a finished story yet. Well, possibly. I mean, you know, as I say, it's not a finished story, you know, so I'm, you know, curious about how this evolves, you know. But, you know, clearly we have something that we can call skillful means, you know, and in the sense we can abstract a lot of things from the Buddhist teaching and use them as skillful means. the result may be actually having available to us a great capacity for skillful means that can be applied and reapplied and reapplied. And, you know, I don't have any argument with that at all. You know, I think it's wonderful, and I see the effectiveness of it, actually. If we're interested, actually, in Nibbana, you know, the third ennobling truth, we want to actually get to the point where skillful means do not need to be applied because the depth of insight, the depth of understanding has actually uprooted the causes of dukkha. This is a gradual process. So it's a gradual process.